Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In history and in our dreams, tinkering and innovating in the garage is as American as apple pie. Thomas Edison, the Wright brothers, and legions of others did it for real. Christopher Lloyd as the wild-eyed Doc did it in Back to the Future. Now, a new era of Americans turned off by the Wall Street life and turned on by new tinkering technology has gone back to the workbench. It's partly for something to do with the economy in the dumps, and partly with the dream of tinkering up the next big breakthrough that could bring the economy roaring back. This hour on Point, Tinkering 2.0 and what it means for innovation in America. Joining me now from New York is Justin Lehart. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's been writing about tinkering, making a comeback for the journal. Justin, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
We couldn't resist a little Back to the Future there. Build a time machine in your garage, and we'll be off to the future. But you're finding an awful lot of people who are doing something just like that, and with some tools in the garage or workshop that would make Doc Brown in Back to the Futures look kind of, sort of in the family. I mean, things are changing in terms of what tinkers can do and what tools are at their disposal.
Yeah, it's really incredible. Just a lot of the machine tools that 10 or 15 years ago would have cost in the hundreds of thousands of dollars even have come down to the point where, you know, someone can afford it, or if they can't afford it, maybe they can get together with some friends and then, you know, together they can afford it. And these tools are really complex. We're talking about, you know, computer numerically controlled mills. We're talking about laser cutters. And you're able to do the type of prototyping work that in the past you would have needed to have a real big R&D facility to do.
Well, good thing, because a lot of R&D, corporate R&D, has been cut back in the recession. But what are you finding in the tinkerer world? What's the pattern out there that's emerging in your reporting, Justin?
Well, there are a lot of things happening at once. First thing, there are groups of people who share tools, so-called hacker spaces. And there are a lot of these, and they run the gamut, and they've really taken off in the
hackerspace,
last year or two.
Hackerspace, not as in computer hacker who wants to come in and vandalize the internet or a computer, but hacker is in the old meaning of sort of picking up the tools at hand and making something.
Yeah, I mean, the term hacker comes from the Tech Model Railroad Club at MIT, and that was where really the computer a lot of the computer revolution came out of that. So it's kind of taking back the root of the word and going and doing something physical and making something new.
Hackerspace is a word I didn't know until I read your article. That is what? They're setting up kind of shops where you can join and come in and have access to a lot of these tools to whip up something new.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they run the gamut. I mean, some of them, they only have a limited number of tools. Some of them have incredible things. Some people have opened up some in the Detroit area, and, of course, they're able to get some pretty cool tools pretty cheaply from the ailing auto industry. So you can see, it's just, you know, it really depends on where you are. But I think what binds them together is that, they're coming together, they're working on tools, and they're working on physical things. And they're sort of melding technology and old school hands-on skills. It's somewhere in between the shop class and the computer lab.
What's the impulse at work here? Are these people who 10 or 15 years ago might have been on the way to Wall Street to an investment bank, and now instead, I don't know, they're disillusioned with that and headed off to make the next time machine or you name it?
I think that is part of the impulse. I think that there definitely was a trend that we saw really even before the economic crisis hit, towards more physical work, towards valuing that. But also, a lot of it is motivated by the drop in the cost of the tools. So for a long time, people who were interested in innovating would go to software. And the reason they would do that is because with a PC, PC is very inexpensive. So it was sort of you, your PC, some open source software, and a lot of coffee, and you could go toe-to-toe with giants. And that's, you know, what basically the guys at Google did. So now you bring down the cost of tools for making physical things. And it's almost like a PC for people in the physical world, for people, for hardware men.
You know what I guess struck me here is I'd almost, not really, but in some way, you kind of begin to forget that Americans like to get their hands dirty, get their hands on material things and make them. The software era and the internet boom lasted so long that it almost began to drift away as something you think about folks doing in this country. But you're found a huge enthusiasm for this. People who really want, in particular, to have material products or you know, discoveries or inventions in their hands to make them.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just that it's more possible now with these tools that are available. And I think that people always wanted to, but it seemed sort of out of reach. And now it's more within reach, so we're seeing more of it.
Is this going to create big stuff or little stuff? I mean, you've got robots and all kinds of things that you describe. You've also got a machine somebody made here to salt the rim of a margarita glass. That doesn't sound like bringing us back from recession, depression, whatever it is.
You know, I think the key when it comes to tinkering is that there's all kinds of crazy things that people do. And there were all kinds of crazy things that people were doing in the past when we had these sort of tinkering revolutions. And you know, who knows what's going to be sort of the really neat thing? You know, for every, you know, someone might be making an artificially intelligent blimp, and that's just sort of a fun thing, right? But then someone else might come up with just, you know, some product that we haven't imagined that really transforms the world.
Justin Lehart joins us from New York City. He's with the Wall Street Journal, a reporter there. His article, recently was Tinkering Makes a Comeback Amid Crisis. With him in the same studio there in New York is Bree Pettis. He's a professional tinkerer. He's co-founder of the NYC Resistor. It's a tech workshop, or hacker space is the kind of a term of art phrase, in Brooklyn, who's also now co-founder of MakerBot Industries. It sells what they call 3D printers. We'll try and get our heads around that. But Bree Pettis, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So before you started your company, you started one of these hackerspaces. This is a workshop where people come in, do what?
Everybody at NYC Resistor is passionate about making things in some way. And we all gathered together, and we'd all been kind of in our own little, in New York, space is really tight. So we all had our own little closet desk with all sorts of boxes and all of our equipment. And we all decided to get together and put it all in one place and share the expense of a clubhouse. And we teach classes, and basically when I come up with a problem that I can't solve, it's very likely that my community there can help me out.
So, and what do you have in your shop? I'm guessing from what Justin's saying, it's not just bandsaws and punch press.
Well, we do have bandsaws. Well, we have one bandsaw, and then we've also got a laser cutter. That was kind of our big purchase that we bought together, because that's kind of expensive. And that's just made so many other projects possible.
Including your own, working on so-called 3D printer. When I first heard that, I had no idea what that meant. What's a 3D printer?
It's really exciting. It's a machine that has the form factor of an old Mac Classic. It's kind of that sort of boxy look. But inside, instead of a monitor, is an extruder that's sort of like a really fancy hot glue gun. And plastic goes in, and it draws a layer of plastic down on a piece of plastic, and then it builds up another layer and another layer and another layer, and then the next thing you know, you've made a digital design and printed it out, and it's right in front of you.
So in other words, this is sort of a factory in a box. You input the dimensions of an object, and it builds that object right there inside your MakerBot.
Yeah. So for example, there's a guy in Germany named Zago, and he designed a whistle. And he uploaded it to the internet, to a site we have called Thingiverse, which is a thing-sharing website.
A thing-sharing website. All right. And so this sounds high-tech enough to be pretty cool, but do you look at this as a big deal? Is this an economy changer, a game changer, or is this, macrame for playing around on the weekend?
Well, the cool thing is, like, once he uploaded his whistle, hundreds of people around the world downloaded and printed out within half an hour. So he was able to transport his idea around the world without any shipping, without any transportation, in no time flat. And, I mean, you can't get a whistle from Germany to New York without a missile, and that's a bad idea.
A whistle and a missile, no thanks.
And so, what we're seeing is people are getting these, and instead normally when we think of needing something, we think, okay, I'm going to go shopping for it. But now you can just think, okay, I'm going to digital design it, or maybe somebody else has done it, and I can just download a design and modify it to make it the way I want. And then, ba-bam, you've got a new doorknob or knob for your air conditioner or a new cup or whatever you want.
Factory in a box. This sounds like big stuff, potentially, Justin, but what's your sense of all this tinkering, the new tinkering going on? Is it a game changer? Is it building the stuff that could bring an economy back or light it up like Thomas Edison did or Henry Ford or Jobs and Wozniak with Apple?
I think that over time we will see some very important and, you know, really transformative technologies come out of this. I don't know when it's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to be sort of right away. I don't know that it's going to be sort of the thing that drags the economy, you know, out of the recession. But, you know, once the expansion gets going, you know, what's going to be leading things? And, you know, my sense is that it may be people, you know, making sort of physical, you know, or physical technology. So, you know, we have the example of the hacker spaces, but also if you go to engineering schools, they're seeing a flourishing in interest on hands-on projects. And the kids in engineering schools are really they're flocking to the workshops in the engineering schools, which for a long time had sort of, you know, kept the workshops away from people, are opening them up again.
Justin Lehart with the Wall Street Journal, please stand by in New York. And Bree Pettis, a co-founder of MakerBot Industries and the NYC Resistor Hackerspace Workshop there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Americans turning back to old-fashioned tinkering and hands-on innovation and whether it may create the next big thing, the next economic boom. Here's from the 1961 film, The Absent-Minded Professor. Fred McMurray plays Professor Ned Brainerd making flubber. Here he works in his home laboratory showing off his invention to his dog, Charlie.
All right, Charlie. Cross your fingers.
The sound of flubber being brewed up in the garage. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's get some in here right now. Dave in Providence, Rhode Island. Dave, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, first of all, thank Justin for defining the word hacker properly. That doesn't happen often enough. The other thing I wanted to comment on is that what I'm seeing in Providence and what I've seen most of the past 5 years and the economy fully going down, plummeting, is that my peers, I'm currently 23, my peers have gone to college, gotten their advanced degrees, come out the other end, and they have their degrees, but no employment. Their choice is either to go back to school or find a mixed job. As a result, that is fueling the innovator economy down here. A lot of my friends are engineers, they are in the electrical field, the chemistry field. And we hang out on weekends and try to come up with products. I had the luck to not actually go to college, learn marketable skills. I have a job. They don't.
But is it for joy and profit or from desperation, Dave, or both that they're going into the hackerspace, the lab, the workshop?
A combination of both. We go in with the idea just to make something purely creative, and at the end of the day, if we come up with something profitable, that makes everyone happy, as well as the people who are buying it.
But the job's not there, so you're at work in the garage. We hope something great comes out of it. We take your point, and we'll look at it. Let me get one more right here from Ann Arbor, Michigan. George. George, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm part of a group of six small independent businesses, engineers and educators, and we have a space in Ann Arbor called the A2 Mech Shop.
Okay.
And just as you've been talking about many of the things, it's not just the sharing of materials, though. We find a big part of it is sharing of ideas and inspiration that comes from the collaborative process. The way the space is set up, the offices are around the outside, and the equipment and common space is in the middle.
It sounds cool. What are people making there, George?
All kinds of things. There's we make Nixie tube clocks, which are like steampunk clocks. There's a group that makes animatronic installations for restaurants and art spaces. My partner and I run Rocks and Robots. We do a summer camp, and we focus on more of the younger hackers.
Right.
And I think the way that we're really going to change things may not be in this economy right away, but when we get a child, I've taught electronics and robotics and computer programming for years. If you get them to turn on and off a pixel on a computer screen, that's interesting. If they turn on and off an LED in the real world with a little microcontroller and a circuit that they built, they jump out of their socks.
So this
and they
is
end up going to engineering school.
So fire up a new generation of Americans to invent things, maybe. George, that's great. Let me get one more right here. Medford, Massachusetts. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I'm building a robot in my basement. 9 months ago, I was principal scientist of a major internet startup where I'd been for 12 years.
Yeah.
And since retiring from that, I decided to basically have fun with my very large and growing collection of tools.
So is it purely for fun, or might you be our next Thomas Edison, sir?
Well, actually, I am filing a bunch of patents. However, they're not actually anything to do with what I've been building so far. I've mostly worked in internet security. But as I've started to look into, the robot I'm building is a model of a Dalek, the Doctor Who monster. But as I started to think, well, it'd be neat if it was remote controlled, and then I thought, well, it'd be even neater if it was capable of autonomous movement. And then I started to think about what it would take to do that. And, you know, I'm starting to have ideas in that field.
Is it more gratifying to be working with a material robot than with internet security for you, Phil, or not?
Well, at least with internet at least with building a robot, you've not got somebody else trying to bash up and destroy what you're doing all the time.
Fair enough. A robot in the basement 9 months after leaving the major company job. Thanks for that. There's three examples right there. I want to go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, if we may. And David Hounshell, he's professor of technology and social change at Carnegie Mellon University, an expert on innovation at the intersection of science and technology and industry and the role of independent inventors and entrepreneurs. David Hounshell, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
So let me ask you first, we'll ask the significance of it, but do you see this surge in tinkering in kind of a garage or hackerspace innovation? Is it on your screen? And then is it something that could, or is it big enough deal to make a difference in our overall economy?
Well, I certainly think it's a fascinating development. I believe that tinkerers have always been with us in U.S. history. Tinkerers have always been an important part of the innovation landscape. And I think what we see, I think as Justin's article points out, is that there are these sort of open sources of technology now with the microprocessor, microcontrollers, microservo mechanisms, very inexpensive machine tools and milling machines, numerically controlled machines. This conjunction that's coming together with a lot of other changes that have taken place over the last couple of decades. And they're coming together at a very propitious moment in American history. And there's no doubt that some really important technologies will come out of this.
Now, I think a lot of people have come to think that, you know, it took major corporate R&D or a huge government plan to get anything that would be on the cutting edge these days. I mean, can you still get out on the frontier from a garage, no matter how fancy the bit of equipment you've got there is?
There are lots of garages in the 20th century and actually in the 21st century that have been the breeding places for major corporations, major innovation that have had innovations that have had great impact on our economy. And you've asked your guest about a play and whether, you know, something good or serious will come out of this. But we have to recognize that historically play has been a very important source for innovation and invention. And so we can't gainsay the importance of just play and tinkering.
But you think, in a time where we've got the Hadron Collider and all these mega scientific endeavors, that we could still come up with some world-changing technology or a product out of a hackerspace, out of somebody's basement?
Yes, because of diversity. Diversity is another important source for innovation. As a I think the more diverse of sources that we have from amateurs and engineers, independent inventors, engineers, scientists, who are working independently, not in a large corporate laboratory or in a large government laboratory, that the greater the diversity and the more open the systems of innovation we have, the greater result we will eventually see in the economy. And I think that's been borne out particularly in the last 30 to 40 years of the 20th century and this first decade of the 21st century.
Justin Lehart there in New York, we had Charles Vest, former president of MIT, on recently, and he was talking about, the need for engineers in this country and engineering education. But one of the interesting, significant veins of response that we got to that online was from out-of-work engineers saying, are you crazy? I mean, one said, why would our young people choose to go into engineering and science? Where are the jobs? Is this the answer to that, Justin Lehart, or is this the evidence that there aren't jobs, as one of our callers said, sort of pushed into the basement by the lack of existing job opportunities?
I guess I'm not sure. I do think that the way, if you talk to young people in engineering schools now, that because the tools have become less expensive, more of them are saying, I'm going to do this, I'm going to make something, and I'm not going to have to go and work for Caterpillar or General Electric or Ford or someplace like that. I'm going to go out and do it myself because I don't have to go to that huge company to get access to the tools. I can get the tools on my own.
And just go out and do it. Let's go to Frank in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Frank, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Just a comment. I think it's wonderful that we're getting back into inventing. We've done it for hundreds of years. The only problem that concerns me is we invent things, and then when it has to be made, it goes overseas for 20 cents an hour, and it doesn't put many of our people back to work.
I wondered the same thing. It's a great question, Frank. Let's pick it up. Bree Pettis in New York. I mean, you've got MakerBot there, and you've sold 400 or more of those this year, I think.
Yep.
But how about it? If this thing really takes off and suddenly you're making thousands, will you have invented it here and then farm the manufacturing out to somewhere in China and, you have five guys employed here and 500 there?
Well, we're really proud about being from Brooklyn, and so we're Brooklyn made. We like it that way. And one of the interesting things that comes up is that we're doing it, but we also have a community of people who are open source, who are around the world, and this idea of open source started with open source software, and now it's moved into hardware. When we actually share all the designs, all the electronic board designs, all the software, all the code is all free. You can just download it. You can have it all. You can build it without us if you really want to. It's actually a lot easier and cheaper to buy it from us. But if you don't have to, there's people out there who are obsessed with doing it themselves and sourcing everything themselves.
So they can download it in China and make it already if they like. You're fine with that.
I mean, it would be kind of a – I would like it if everybody bought from us because we put a lot of work and sweat into it. But the truth is the people who do it themselves without us end up coming up with all these great innovations that then they share back into the community.
David Hounshell, you're our professor here. What about it? You hear the suspicion that these days innovate in America, but the jobs or manufacturing won't stay here anyway. A kind of there's a certain maybe defeatism in that, but there's a hard reality that people have experienced too.
Well, of course, we do have an important division of labor in the world with comparative advantage taking place. And I think the United States' comparative advantage has been in innovation, on the frontier of innovation. And I think as long as we have people like Bree here, we are fine. I think if we really don't need to worry so much about manufacturing jobs. As long as we have enough innovators and can really secure the major gains from the innovation.
I want to look at that more and how that works. I mean, there's a certain number of innovators, but, of course, manufacturing jobs have put a lot of meals on the table over years. Rob in Norfolk, Virginia. Rob, you're on the air.
How are you doing, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you know, Rob?
I am a 20-year-old engineering student at Old Dominion University, and I started my skateboard company, XPC Longboards, from my garage, actually out in Chesapeake. And we now sell online all over the United States and internationally. pretty much from my desire as an engineering student to build it better, because I thought I could do it better than anything else on the market.
So to build a better skateboard, was it a high-tech process or not, Rob?
Well, it was to figure it out. We do custom boards. We can do anything you can do on a computer on a deck, and it costs us nothing extra. So we have a process that's extremely cheap for me because I was able to develop it without the overhead of a normal big company.
That's pretty great, and we hope it goes like gangbusters. Bree Pettis in New York, we've heard a lot about new technology making this possible. I wish you could explain some of that, like the high-tech milling machines and, what was it, laser cutter you said? I mean, what mm-hmm. do these permit that couldn't be easily done before?
Well, the cool thing about digital design is you can take an idea and using your computer, you can make a physical object mm-hmm. without having to go into the workshop at all. And in some, and then you can go ahead, if you've got a laser cutter, if you've got a MakerBot, if you've got a CNC mill, you can just send your design to it and it makes it for you. So in some ways, what I really like about this digital manufacturing from digital design to object is that it lets you, first of all, iterate really fast. You don't have to send it off someplace to be mm-hmm. made. It's just like right, it's on your desktop.
Make it again, make it different, better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can iterate really quickly. So you can get to a product much faster. And I mean, I get really excited about that, like a skateboard company like that, because that's somebody who's like they want a better skateboard and they're doing it. They don't have to send off and write a letter to somebody saying, can you please make me a skateboard like this, that, the other. They can just be like, bam, I'm coming out with a skateboard company, and it'll just grow depending on how much people are passionate about their skateboard.
Justin, you report about a fellow in his college dorm room with a very high-tech milling machine sort of, you know, tucked under a shelf by the peanut butter, and he's making new products there.
Yeah, he's an MIT student, and he has access to fabulous tools there. He can use a laser cutter. He can use, you know, all kinds of things. But he decided that walking 4 or 5 blocks was just too much. So he went out and got one, got a little mill, and hooked it up to his computer and everything. And it's underneath the shelf with the peanut butter on it. It has a little plexiglass case on it, so he doesn't get iron, you know, doesn't get metal filings
in his lunch. And what kind of products are he and others making that you found, Justin?
Well, he's one of these fixed wheel bicycle freaks. So he's making sprockets for fixed wheel bicycles, and he started out. He's prototyping them, but he wants to start a company where you can, you'll be able to design your own sort of nice pattern on a fixed wheel sprocket and send it to him, and then he'll send you a sprocket back.
A sprocket back from a milling machine on the shelf by his college dorm bed. I'm still trying to get my head, David Hounshell, around whether this is the seedbed of, you know, some engine that will pull or help pull the U.S. economy out of its ditch, or whether this is fun for fun's sake. Nothing wrong with that, but it's a difference. There's a difference economically, maybe.
Well, a couple of points, Tom. First of all, any major innovation, be it the telephone or radio or the personal computer, takes a long time to have an impact on the economy. Mm-hmm. And we have to keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And second is this phenomenon of being able to prototype rapidly is very important, and is what led innovators like Thomas Edison actually to establish their laboratories like Menlo Park and other laboratories and other inventors.
Some comments from the web. Here's John says, I think Yankee ingenuity is alive and well. We'll meet the challenges the economy is throwing at us. Here's from Patricia, a recent MBA grad tinkering in his garage, says, I was able to develop those foldable shoes that ladies carry in their purse for the times when their feet hurt. In 5 months, we've expanded distribution to 15 stores. That's going somewhere. And here's one from Keith saying the return, quote-unquote, to hands-on tinkering is an entirely urban phenomenon. Rural America never stopped creating new machines in the garage or barn. Take a look at Farm Show Magazine or machinebuilders.net. Keith, we will do that. Let me get a call from Jeff in Boston. You're on the air, Jeff.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to sort of reemphasize the point that some of your guests have made, that I don't
actually think that the impact of this sort of rediscovery or reemergence of the tinkering culture is going to come from some one big product or discovery or company, but it's going to be more profound and subtle. It's going to be a lot like the PC revolution. The PC revolution didn't change the world, didn't change our society because there's an Apple, for instance, or a Microsoft or a Google. It's because of all the zillions of little companies and other companies that can use that technology to do things they never could have done 20 or 30 years ago. And it's very analogous. In the 60s, computers were something only universities and huge corporations could afford to play around with. And then in the 70s, the technology became accessible to hobbyists, and they started to screw around with them. And you have people like Wozniak and Jobs creating the first Apples in basically in their garage. And that's where we are in the tinkering revolution right now.
But, Jeff, I want to be sure I understand your point, because it seems to my mind that, in fact, what they developed, Wozniak and Jobs and the rest, was indeed kind of the next big thing. Yes, it spawned a gazillion companies and ideas, but that was the fuel for a whole generation of economic activity. Was it not? Are you saying that's coming again, maybe, or not?
I'm saying that there's no one particular invention that came out of the PC revolution that the world would not have changed if it hadn't existed. If there was no Apple computer, if there was a different company that made something slightly different, we still would have had that same kind of transformation. It was the fact that that technology got into the hands of the population at large that allowed the changes of the last 20 years to happen. And it's going to be the same way now. It won't be... You won't necessarily be able to point and say, oh, that's the thing that changed, or that's the thing. It'll be, you'll look around 20 years from now, and you'll be like, wow, people just make so much more new stuff now, and it's everywhere, and everyone has access to it. That's really changed the way we think about what can I have in my life, or what can I do with what I've got in my head, and how can I get it to other people.
We've got it, Jeff, and thank you for your call. David Hounshell, is that what you're anticipating here, kind of nation of tinkerers emerging, or?
I would agree with Jeff, and I would point out with respect to the personal computer is that there were economists that were worried for a long time about what they called the productivity paradox up until the mid-1990s. PC had been around for 15 years or more than 15 years, and they hadn't seen any results in terms of productivity growth in the United States. And it took a long time to assemble a lot of things, software, networking, human skills actually in using personal computers, and finally we began to see this enormous productivity growth as a result of the PC, internet working, World Wide Web connection. So I think Jeff has a very important point.
But the PC itself was an innovation and kind of breakthrough. I mean, was it not in the same way we look at electricity or steam or automobile manufacturing? I mean, these things set off whole eras. I mean, tinkering generically doesn't do that, does it? Don't you have to come up with some particular...
Ensembles of technology and systems. I think those are very important things. No, I think no particular invention is going to set something off, whether it's a locomotive or whether it's a telephone or whether it's a personal computer.
Well, why not?
It has to fit into an ensemble of technologies and fold into the economy and be adopted very broadly before it has major impact.
But isn't it, I mean, you come up with, let's say, a new battery technology right now. Everybody's talking about that being necessary for green tech to really take off. Presumably somebody could come up with that on their hackerspace, David Hounshell.
Absolutely, and there are people working on batteries now, and that's a good place for somebody who has a lot of skills, both scientific and mechanical skills, to make a contribution. And it could be that we see out of hacker spaces where the problems with batteries will be solved and we will be able to have all-electric cars that will be really sustainable.
Speaking of electricity, we've got a call from Schenectady, New York, and Lucy. Hi, Lucy. You're on the air.
Yes.
Hi.
I'm an inventor.
Great.
And the second invention I want to talk about, which is a magnetic electric pin sweeper. I have the drawing, and I need to patent it. Secondly...
A magnetic electric pin sweeper.
Yes,
so if you have pins like that have fallen on the floor...
And your computer. And now I have a call for it in one of the grocery stores. Opening the boxes, there's pins in the... I should know about it. My father used to work with paper. area.
Right.
You know those, what do you call it, race that's put on the boxes? They
yeah.
fall off?
Yeah.
And they need the machine now. I have to call for it. And what's happening, I need to have it made by a manufacturer. And also, I will get the patent on it as soon as I can send off this. Very reasonable.
Well, Lucy, let us see what our sort of new age tinkerers say to that kind of project. I mean, Bree, is this something that your 3D printer can deal with? Lucy's got an magnetic electric pin sweeper. So can you whip that up in your computer driven box?
Yeah, I mean, one of the cool things is that up until now, if you wanted to make a vacuum cleaner for pins or mm-hmm. Any kind of new thing that people haven't thought up yet, you had to go to an elite institution or send it off and have it made. And it's kind of like back in the old days when there were computers and there were mainframes. And in order to use them, you had to either sneak in on the weekends or like go to that college and book time on it. And then when the Altair 8080 came out and the Apple I, you had people all of a sudden they could have it on their desktop at home. And sure, they were clunky, but it was a major step forward into being able to hack on it yourself. And we're seeing that with 3D printers. So people can have an idea, try it out, see if it's actually viable, get an idea of a design, and then if you want to take it even farther, you can just publish it. You can share it and get a community of people who might have the same problem.
But how far does that go? I mean, can you really? You describe this as like a super a hot glue gun in a box. Can you make a magnetic electric pin sweeper with that, or just doorknobs and air conditioner knobs?
You know what? That's an exciting challenge. And the cool thing is, right now, it's a total frontier. I'm not exactly sure what that vacuum cleaner looks like, but if there's a digital design, it can be prototyped and then manufactured.
Lucy, thank you for your call. Good luck with that. Amherst, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You asked before if there was, anything important and practical coming out of someone's garage or whether it would be just frivolous little things.
And I'm ready to believe. Tell us, what have you got?
If there was a solar furnace that could replace gas and oil-fired furnaces in the United States, would it be significant?
Sign me up, baby.
I'll be over to your house next week.
Are you working on it, Kevin?
I'm welding it together now.
A solar furnace. How does it work?
It's a mirror array that tracks the sun, and heat is transferred to a storage facility in your basement, and I've got it to the point where it can store a week's worth of heat. You can go without sun for a week and still get heat out of it.
That sounds pretty great. So what's your next step, Kevin? How do you put this in every house in America?
Finish building it, test it for a year on a couple of houses with friends who are willing to have me plummet into their house. And then look for someone who can help me manufacture it.
It sounds pretty great, Kevin. We wish you luck with it. I hope I'd love the sound of solar furnaces and houses all over the place, and hope it comes out to be a big one. Thanks for your call. Let's get another from Wayland, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a mechanical engineer. I work for a couple big companies over mm-hmm. my career.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say that. For anything meaningful to come out of these garages, you need really good solid science behind it, which means you need people that have, attended universities and have, real high technical knowledge, because this is the times we live in nowadays.
Right.
And these people, in order to do this in their garage, I mean, they need an income. They need jobs with health insurance and enough salary to pay the mortgage. I don't really see, that engineers... they're laid off pretty quickly nowadays, and
mm-hmm.
I just don't see how many people are really going to make significant impacts when they don't have a paycheck, just trying to do some little project in the garage.
And let us pick it up. Who wouldn't understand that? David Hanschel, how about it? I mean, there's a very nuts and bolts question about how people are supposed to sustain themselves to really do this, bring a whole lot of technological and scientific insight to their garage, but they still have to eat. Do we have a system that can work around this kind of innovation now?
Well, the problem of laid off engineers is definitely a problem now, and it has been historically at various moments when we've had recessions. End of World War II, very briefly, especially at the end of the Vietnam War, another cycle in 1991 before the big change in the 90s. Particularly, it's harder on older engineers that tend to get laid off, and companies hire newer engineers. And that's a real problem. And I think that Ann has a point. And I don't see a solution to that in any immediate short term.
Justin Lehar, what did you find among the tinkerers you spoke with? Did they seem held back by a less than fully out there on the frontier scientific education, or by the challenges of not necessarily having job and paycheck and health care? Those can be pretty big impediments, or not.
Well, I guess a couple of things. First thing, Stealing Bree's thunder and talking a little bit about MakerBot, those guys do not have engineering educations, and they made a 3D printer or a rapid prototyping machine, as they're called. And I kind of think that if they had that kind of education, they might have thought that what they were doing was impossible. Bree can speak to that. The other thing is that what we are seeing is that a lot of these sort of little startups are employing engineers that have been laid off. In Michigan, for example, before someone called in from A2 Mech Shop, there's actually a company there are a number of companies that have come out of A2 Mech Shop. One of them is an electric scooter company called Current Motor Company. And they've actually been hiring people who were laid off from Ford, GM, and so on. And these guys are really gassed to be – I mean, they're taking a lower paycheck, but they're really gassed to be, like, welding and building things again. So there's definitely – you know, this is a place where people who maybe have lost their job can go and do something and apply their skills.
And it's not – we're not just kidding ourselves with this. Ann kind of suggests that, you know – technology is so advanced now that you can't do it out of your back pocket. You know, that maybe it's got to be a big R&D effort, maybe even a corporate effort. You see evidence that from this smaller infrastructure base, great stuff could happen, is happening?
Well, I don't know how small the infrastructure is, because one of the things, and we haven't talked about this, is that the internet really has enabled this in a lot of ways, that you can get the information and you can find the community that will tell you, you know, I have a problem. How do I deal with this? And they'll say, you know, this is how you do it. Or I had the same problem. This is how I worked around it.
Huh. Wow. Maybe scale coming that way with a lot of people tied together over the net. David, in Arlington, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The point I'd like to add to this great conversation is I'm very excited by this. I feel that this attitude, I see it all over the place. I'm a tinkerer. I invent stuff in my garage. I feel it's helping us move back towards a society focused on building real things and providing real services instead of relying on fantasy money and second-level derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to producing something solid of value that requires real expertise to produce. I think that's what's going to help differentiate ourselves from global competition, and that will help drive our economy.
Maybe a very welcome culture change here, David Hounshell. I mean, I have to say, in recent months, you know, you hear people talking about, well, I think I'm going to start an electric car company. I just didn't hear much talk like that over the last 20 years, and suddenly it's back, and people are actually doing it, empowered by technology, like Bree Pettis, one of those people like Jay Lehart's writing about, and people actually dreaming and doing, you know, physical production of cutting-edge things. To me, it does have a new feel to it, or at least a new cycle coming up, David.
I have a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, historians like to talk about a major shift that took place in U.S. history, largely around the turn of from the 19th to the 20th century. They talk about the United States shifting from a producer culture to a consumer culture. And I think that we could certainly agree that in the late 20th century, the United States did become a really massive consumer culture. That's one of the things that got us into such trouble with our economy. And historians also like, and sociologists like to talk about post-industrial society. And now we're well beyond post-industrial society in many respects in terms of manufacturing jobs being taken over. And now to see a return to a producer culture is really an exciting development.
Well, talk about Back to the Future. Maybe we are in the midst of it right now, and it is exciting to get hands-on and break open some new frontiers. We hope there's big stuff in it for everybody. Grateful to each of you for being with us this hour. It's just been great. David Hounshell at Carnegie Mellon University. Thank you very much, Professor, for being with
us.
It's
been fun.
Bree Pettis, co-founder of Mark MakerBot Industries in Brooklyn. Thank you very much, Bree, for being here. Good luck to you.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
And Justin Lehart with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for your reporting, Justin. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.